afternoon. Education Finance Committee will come to order. And I know people are still trickling in from the floor session, which is just fine, but I thought we might as well. I'm going to make a real effort to try to start us on time, but when we have a little session over the lunch break, it makes it a little more difficult. So with that, we just have our minutes from yesterday in the packets. Let's see, Representative Murphy, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that the minutes be approved as printed.
All right. Representative Murphy has moved adoption of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Murphy. All right. And so per our beginning yesterday with presentations from our nonpartisan staff, Ms. Adrians and Mr. Strom, we will continue with that. And I think we were in the midst of the PowerPoint when we took our break.
Madam Chair, page 27.
Thank you. Page 27. So, members, everything should still be in your packets from yesterday. And slide 27 is where we took our break. So it says major components of the school finance system. It's page 14, but slide 27. All right, very well. So with that, Mr. Strom, please continue.
Madam Chair, members, thanks very much. We're going to start on slide 27 on page 13. Yesterday we stopped just as we got to the K-12 part of the system, and what we want to talk a little about now is the components of that system. In a couple of slides here, we'll go to general education, and then we're going to take a little detour into how to read a general ed printout and talk about the way that that's set up. We want to start by letting you know that for the school year that just ended, the 2015-2016 school year, which is fiscal 16, $12.37 billion of revenue for the K-12 system, and 53% of that's from the general ed program, about 5.5% are the voter-approved operating referendums, 2.8% is from something called local optional revenue. About 9% of the total education revenue for school districts is from special education formulas. And when we talk about special ed formulas, we'll talk more in depth about this. Most school districts spend about double that on special education. There's some reasons why it may make sense to have that formula funded where the revenue doesn't equal the expenditures. And we'll talk about some of those. But for most districts, about half of their special ed revenue comes from the state special ed formulas, and the other half of what they need to spend comes from their general fund. Community service, the school districts have a fund to provide ECFE, school readiness, and other early learning and adult education programs. That's all in a fund called the Community Service or Community Education Fund. About 2% of a district's revenue is in those, are part of that fund. About 10% of the revenue comes for facility purposes. Almost all of that revenue is from the local property tax. We'll go through some equalization examples of how debt service equalization works a little later this legislative session. In short, when a school district builds a new building, they sell bonds to pay for the construction costs, and then over often a 20-year period, they'll repay those bonds. There's a little bit of state aid involved in that program, but about $600 or $700 million currently is voter-approved building debt each year where the district makes the annual bond payments. Federal funds in Minnesota are a pretty small share of the pie. About 5.5% of the average school district budget is federal. That's in three categories, special education, food service funds, and in Title I area, and then little bits of grants and other title money as well. But generally speaking, for most districts, the federal funds are at the margin. The federal funds tend to be very tightly controlled by the federal rules for those funds as well. So for most school districts, the federal funds are only for the specific purpose for which they are received. And then for the average district, about 4% of its total revenue comes from fees. Most of those are for things like school lunch fees and athletic fees and that kind of thing, but there are also some fees that are essentially inter-district payments. Since we fund on a per-pupil basis, most of those aren't related to regular student movement, but there's a little bit of cross-district payments that go into the fees category. So, again, those are the major categories of revenue. The in-sources for funding for the schools in Minnesota, $12.4 billion. And if you look at that 53.4% on the next slide, that's the amount that's in the general education revenue. $7.6 billion of that total revenue is all in one program called general education revenue. And there's about 10 subcategories as well as the basic formula allowance. The basic formula allowance is set in statute. It's currently at $6,067 per pupil unit. There's no statutory increase in that number. So if that number goes up, it's due to legislation that gets adopted by this committee. One rule of thumb that Ms. Adrians and I use, for every dollar that you want to raise the formula allowance, it costs $1 million statewide. So if you want to raise the formula allowance by $100 from $6,067 to $6,167, the rule of thumb, a dollar, each dollar costs $1 million. That's $100 million per year. So if you went up $100 the first year, it would cost you $100 million in the first year. You'd need to pay that $100 million out to stay at that level in the second year. With a $6,067 formula allowance, often people talk about a percentage increase. A 1% increase would be a $61 increase. Again, using our rule of thumb, $61 million the first year. To keep it at that level in the second year would be another $61 million. And to add a second 1% in the second year, about $61 million as well. So the rule of thumb is sort of $180 million for each percentage point if you're going to go one and one. If you were going to go two and two, that would be double that. That would be $360 million. But that rule of thumb, there's some little bit of rounding involved in that, but it's pretty darn close for a lot of reasons. So just sort of keep that in mind. It's a quick way to evaluate how much some of these things will cost. Other elements of general education all vary by district. That 71% in the basic formula allowance is the same, but the other categories are all set in statute, and they all intentionally vary. There's a 14-inch piece of paper-turned landscape in your packet, and that shows the general education revenue by category for each school district. And why don't we take just a second to talk about how to read a printout here. Oftentimes, school district funding is much easier to understand if there's district-by-district examples. Ms. Adrians and I will tend to put summary lines on the top of printouts so you can see by region or whatever other kind of grouping you'd like to see. In Minnesota, we have 330 school districts and an ever-changing number of charter schools, currently about 165 charter schools. In this committee, we tend to put out printouts that are in district order. You can see the very left column there is the district number. And while some people prefer alphabetical, the one nice thing about the district order is it generally matches county alphabetical order. So, for example, Hennepin County is the 27th county of the 87 counties, and the school districts in Hennepin County tend to have the first two of their three numbers be 27. So 271, 272, 273, et cetera, are the Hennepin County numbers. Ramsey County is the 62nd county, so the five school districts in Ramsey County are 621 through 625. So by using district number, that actually groups your districts by those other districts in the same county, and that's sometimes a helpful way to see changes. As I said, we're able to sort this. Ms. Adrians and I are happy to sort printouts however you want or to group revenue differently. Our usual limitation is just there's only so much we can put on a piece of paper. For a variety of reasons, including trying to get as many columns on a piece of paper as possible, we'll almost always show revenue on a per-pupil basis. We'll show the pupil count in the first column usually, and then the subsequent revenue amounts as a per-pupil amount going across the page. So, for example, on this estimated baseline revenue for fiscal year 2017, you can see the first column is pupil count. That's our funding pupil count at 930,294 pupils statewide. And then you can see the 71.4% of general ed revenue is all in the basic category, and that's $6,067 per pupil unit in each school district. And as you look up and down the printout, you can see that that's the same for every school district or in charter school, regardless where they're located. Then each of the rest of the columns here is a component of general education with a separate formula. And revenue tends to vary by the way that those formulas are established. And much of the time in this committee, we'll be looking at those formulas and determining whether they're meeting their objectives or not. And just very quickly, as we go across the page, extended time revenue is for those school programs that run longer in the school day or school year. On average, you can see $68 per pupil. And as you look up and down the list, you can see the variation by district. Compensatory revenue is just about $600 per pupil unit on the baseline for the current year. You can look up and down the list there and see that there's pretty wide variation. About $550 million statewide is in compensatory revenue. And because it's a concentration formula, it depends not only on the number of free and reduced lunch students in the district, but also on the percentage concentration at each school site. Compensatory revenue is one of the few formulas that's computed at the site level. And if this year is like any other, you'll see a number of bill drafts intended to modify the compensatory revenue in one form or another. English language learner revenue averages $61 statewide, but you can see there's some pretty big differences up and down the list as well. We have a component. The next component of general education revenue is for school districts that are small in size. If they have 960 or fewer pupils, there's a formula to provide some additional funding for them. Then the next column, operating sparsity revenue, is for those districts that are geographically isolated. It basically measures the distance between a school building and the next nearest school. Only $29 on average per pupil, but as you look up and down the list, you can see that there's some school districts where that's more than $3,000 of additional money. It doesn't cost this committee much to fund that because there aren't many kids in those districts, but operating sparsity has the widest diversity of revenue of any of the regular components of general education. In the mid-90s, our pupil transportation formula, which was cost-based, was replaced with money rolled into the formula, and then a separate category of funding called transportation sparsity revenue. This formula provides additional money for school districts based on a couple of indexes that are related to the square mile area of the district and the number of students residing in that district. It's no longer a cost-based formula, but instead essentially keys off the sparsity in the district. And again, you can see pretty wide range up and down the list for transportation sparsity. School districts get a relatively small amount of money for operating capital purposes. I know that's an accounting oxymoron. That's really a small amount of facilities and equipment money can be spent on either or both of those, but only those types of things. There's a long list in statute of the eligible expenditures in the equipment and facilities area. It's weighted by the age of the buildings in the district, why there's a little bit of variation among the districts. But you can see at the top line by the averages, there's really no difference statewide. But for individual districts or, metro, non-metro, but for individual districts, there's a little variation because there's a building age index involved. We have a formula called the equity revenue formula that provides money for school districts depending on how large the referendum is in the district. Essentially, the smaller the referendum, the larger the equity revenue. And you can see that varies a fair amount by district, but it's a relatively small amount, $120 per pupil. Very small amount for gifted and talented, $13 per pupil unit set aside for that purpose. Transition revenue is a nice name for a grandperson or grandfather revenue. There's about 101 things since the early 1980s that are all rolled into that category. So for each district, the items that make transition revenue are different. Average is $32 per pupil. The three adjustment columns will generally hide on the spreadsheet for you. There's an adjustment for transfers of money to the academies for the state academies for the deaf and blind in Faribault. There's an adjustment for transportation when a school district is required to provide transportation to charter schools. And there's a third adjustment for referendum money when a child attends another district or attend for the aid portion or a charter school. So those three adjustments usually won't show up on the printout. They do have some effect, but usually they're cost for services like with the transportation, where when the charter school chooses to have the district provide the transportation, there's some money flowing back and forth between the school district and the charter school. Then a couple more columns, and we'll get to the total here. The operating referendum, because of the way the statute is worded, the voter-approved operating referendum is actually part of the general education program. That averages about $803 per pupil right now. Up to $300 of that can be approved by school boards, and as a change that happened in the 2013 session. So when you look up and down the printout, you'll see a number of districts are at $300 of referendum authority per pupil. That's because they can do that by board action. They don't need their voters to approve that first $300. Referendum revenue is capped. For a district not eligible for sparsity revenue, the cap's about $1,900 or thereabouts. So a school district, even if it wanted to pass a larger amount of referendum than that, is limited to that cap for the year. The next component is declining enrollment revenue. School districts get a small amount of revenue for when they're in decline. Some people are big fans of this, others not so much. A former chair used to refer to these as ghost pupils. But essentially what happens is one of every four pupils that leaves the district gets counted for one more year. So if your enrollment in your district were dropping by 100 pupils, in that first year you'd get 25 pupils counted for that year. If it stayed at that same level the next year, there'd be no additional declining pupils. So it really counts those pupils one more time, counts essentially a quarter of those pupils one more time. The pension adjustment has about six changes to it that have been added together, but essentially what that does is that that accounts for some of the different requirements that the state has put on districts for pension adjustments. The way teacher retirement works in Minnesota, all but St. Paul now are combined into the state TRA fund. The statute lists the employee and the employer contribution rates, and the school district, as the employing authority, pays that into the TRA fund on the basis of its payroll. And then the employee share is paid into the fund as well. The TRA board has proposed for this session an increase in the employer contribution rate. This committee will no doubt be hearing about that during the session, and the Pension Commission will also be dealing with that issue. Whether or not that is a funded item and whether it would go in the pension adjustment is a decision for this committee to make. But something that members of this committee should be aware of is that TRA does have a proposal to increase, among other things, to increase the employer contribution rate for school district folks that are in TRA. The last column of revenue was created in 2013 as well, and that was a column of revenue that was originally named one thing and now another, and so Ms. Adrians and I may refer to that by the wrong name half the time, but the initials are the same. Local optional revenue is the name that it currently goes by, or LOR. That allows a district by school board approval essentially to put $424 into the local optional revenue column. If the district had a referendum at the time, that $424 would come off the referendum. But otherwise, a district with no referendum could, by board action, have another $424 per pupil. And we add all those columns up across the page then, and you get to that last column, the total general education revenue for the school district. And you can see that, again, as you look at the top of that, the averages by different groups don't change all that much, but the averages by individual district vary quite a bit. And again, the three factors that cause the greatest variation are sparsity, compensatory, and the operating referendum. And so you can look up and down the revenue list for total general education revenue and see that they vary quite a bit. Those variations are required by statute. They don't exist by accident. They exist by previous legislative directive that each of those formulas should be constructed the way it is. So, Madam Chair, members, if you go back then to the pie chart that's on the PowerPoint, you can see that these amounts total $7.6 billion and see the relative shares statewide for each of these parts of general education revenue.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, so the operating referendum, aside from the $300, that's local money?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, operating referendum is equalized, and we'll talk about equalization a bit. So there's some state aid for the lower property wealth school districts. on the referendum, but the majority of that is provided through the local property tax. Some very low revenue districts will have more than half of that, or low property based districts will have more than half of that provided in state aid. But for most districts, particularly in the metro area, the operating referendum is primarily from the local tax base.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Adrians.
If I could interrupt and give Tim a second to catch his breath. There's a lot of information in that he just gave you, and I think Harry passed these books out to everybody. And so in the books, in the guides that my predecessors put together, there's a lot of information, detailed information about each of those columns. So in case you need a reference or a guide to go back to, it's a good resource.
Yes, thank you. That's a good reminder. The highly coveted financing education in Minnesota books are at each of your places, so you have your own copy. If you need more, let us know. But it is a very good publication and a good reminder if you want to refresh, if you've been through this before or learning newly about all of these formulas and different funding streams that we have. It's very helpful. All right. Any other questions? All right,
and
we'll move
Madam
on.
Madam Chair, that's general education revenue. Yesterday, Representative Dabney asked about the compensatory part of that and the free and reduced lunch count. We'll talk about that later, if you like. And again, the culture of this committee is clear to folks, any member, of course, is allowed to ask Ms. Adrians or me anything that they want in private. But in general, the culture in this committee has been if a member has a question about a thing that's asked, other people in the committee are interested, so we tend to provide that information to the full committee. And we certainly don't want to violate any confidentiality, but in general, when that question gets asked, we don't respond just to the author. We respond to the committee so that members that are hearing the discussion can all have a copy of that printout.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Strom. And the pages are going to hand out the information that, per Representative Dabney's question yesterday, that you forwarded, and we were able to get copies made for all of the committee members, so those will come around right now.
Okay. And Madam Chair, we'll move on with this presentation, and then we'll come back to that printout if that's okay with you.
That sounds good.
So if you go back a graph to that one that's labeled slide 27, you can see general education's about 53% of the total, and special ed's about 9%. And when you come forward two slides to slide 29, you can see what's happened to special education aid over time. The department prepares a very nice document for us each year called the Cross-Subsidy Report that looks at the difference between school districts' special education revenue and their expenditures. But the takeaway message from this slide is essentially that state special education aid has been increasing over the last 15 years, has gone from $762 to about $1,400 on average. And so even though there's a big shortfall in that fund, the state legislature's been putting substantially more money in the special education portion of the formula. One other note, unlike general ed that does not have any automatic growth assigned to it, the special education formula, while somewhat complicated, part of it is a 4% annual growth rate built into the formula, and that's one of only two formulas in the K-12 area where there's automatic growth built into it. The other one is the adult basic education formula, and otherwise the K-12 formulas don't have any automatic growth built into it. It's up to this committee to decide how much growth, if any, to put in each of those categories. We're not going to spend much time on this today. We'll have a series of printouts. Usually what happens in this committee is that when members bring bills forward or we have a more substantial discussion on any of these issues, Ms. Adrians and I will prepare printouts for you to show revenue by individual district in each of the categories that's listed on this other general fund list. We're happy to summarize those however folks want. But again, that sort of that district-by-district listing is not just for parochial basis. It really gives folks a sense of how things are distributed across the state. We can look at general fund revenue per student over time, and this is not too important for you for this purpose, but you can see how that general fund revenue has changed over the last 15 years on slide 31.
Mr. Strom, we do have a question for Representative Scott.
Thank you. Mr. Strom, you mentioned that there's a 4% automatic increase in special ed built in? Is that annually or by the biennium?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, there's a couple of twists to that formula, but that 4% is essentially built in each year. So it's a big increase in the special ed area that's built into the initial basic formula.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions about that? All right. Please continue.
And then, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
Yes, please.
I was too quick. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize if this is jumping around, but in this book that was just handed on page 3, there is a chart, and it has a tax rate beginning in years 2014-15 of 0.35%. What does that tax rate compared to the basic formula allowance mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, we used to have something called the General Education Levy, and there's been a lot of fights about that levy. That levy was eliminated in 2001 legislative session by the agreement that the House and the Senate and Governor Ventura reached. Essentially, that was for general education back up through that point in time. A substantial amount of the general education money came from the local property tax, and that tax rate was essentially uniform across all the districts. All the other property taxes schools had are on top of that, but that rate was uniform across all the districts, and so the aid would fill in behind that. So at that point in time, some of the most property wealthy districts in the state were those that had power plants, and they may have had sufficient tax base that they got very little state aid on general education because that same uniform rate that they had raised almost the full amount of general education revenue, whereas a district back then like Farmington, for example, was very low property tax wealth, and so the vast majority of their general ed revenue then was coming from the state aid because that same rate against the small base raised relatively few dollars. So the general education tax rate that you see on page 3 there shows what that rate was in the years before that rate was phased out, and then, I should have looked at the chart. and so those are years up until 2003, and then from 2003 all the way up to 2014, there was no general education levy. And then it came back at a rate that was about a hundredth of what it used to be for just 4 years, and that was something that this committee voted to repeal two sessions ago. It came back as about a $20 million levy, was in place for 3 years as a $20 million levy. Next year will be a $10 million levy. I'm so sorry about that. So the 35% and 30% was what that was for most of the 80s and 90s, right in that range. And then when it came back for the last 4 years, was just at that very small amount. So a 0.3 tax rate against the total tax base in the state only raised about $20 million. And then that's now, if this chart were to go through 2019 and 2018, that rate will be about 0.15%, and then in 2019 it'll be back to zero. I'm sorry, I should have looked at the chart before. Could have saved a long-winded explanation. Madam Chair, members, then the next couple of slides we're going to go pretty quick through that just show general fund revenue per student and then the aid component of that per student as well. The difference, obviously, between general fund aid and general fund levy is the local property tax. And again, here, these charts are all for a variety of reasons starting in 2003, and that's the year after that general education levy was eliminated. So had we gone back further with these charts, some other changes happened to the system that make it kind of complicated for us to go prior to 2003, but we're happy to do so. But if you were to go back before that, you'd see that state aid was quite a bit lower for 2002 and years prior to that because of the general education levy. The next chart, slide 33, shows what's happened to the general fund property tax portion over time. And then when we look at the next chart, this sort of shows how the overall state aid, property tax, and federal aid have gone over time. You can see that in 2003 there, that huge jump up to almost 75% of all total K-12, pre-K to 12 revenue was from state aid, and that property tax dropped way down to 8% of the total. That federal funds line on the color graph that you can see on the screen, the very bottom dotted line, about 6%. We had 1 year of spike up to 12% in 2010 due to the federal stimulus money. But otherwise, that federal money, very small, very consistent portion, about 6%. The property tax money has slowly increased over the last 5 years, but not very much. But you can see some big changes in the late 90s, and then that change in 2001 pushed the state aid, the total state aid up to a total of 75%. And that dropped a little bit each year until 2010, about when it got to be as low as 62% again. And then now you can see it's back up to about 67%. And over the last several years, been pretty consistent at that level. The next slide, Representative Thiessen was asking about the operating referendum. This shows the state share of that. So on average, and you can see it's kind of lumpy, but you can see in 2005 the state was paying about a quarter of the operating referendum based on equalization aid. That fell in 2011 to as low as 8.2%. And then you can see that with the changes that the 2013 legislature adopted in the tax committee, you can see that popped back up to about 23%, and now 3 years later we're at about 20%. On the total referendum. So the average district, if they have a $1,000 referendum, the average district, $800 is going to come from the local property taxpayers and $200 from state aid. There aren't really any average districts, so some districts are getting a fair amount more than that and some a fair amount less. Important to point out that the operating referendum is one of the four or five levies that's on referendum market value. So our tax base calculation for that excludes the ag lands and the seasonal rec property. By excluding the ag land, what that tends to mean is a bunch of those rural districts with a lot of farmland are getting some equalization aid under the operating referendum. It tends to be the districts that are not getting any either have some sort of large commercial industrial development or other types of development like that that'll push them off the equalization formula. And again, we'll spend some time at a little bit later date talking about equalization and how that works. And I'm sure there'll be some bills this year on the modification to the equalization aid formulas. I think we'll skip over the next few charts. This is a way of grouping things. Again, we always are in the position of making arbitrary decisions about how to group information, what should go in what category. We often find that size of school district is helpful, as well as metro and non-metro. There's nothing magical about that. There's many a number of school districts that are actually split between metro and non-metro counties, and so there isn't necessarily a real reason to do it metro non-metro, although it's one of the ways that we can help analyze how changes affect different school districts in the state. Sometimes we'll separate charters out. Sometimes we'll have charters included in the location where they're at. And again, if members have preferences, Ms. Adrians and I are glad to adjust the totals at the top of the page, however folks would like to see those. Other school funding trends are then shown on the next few pages, and I don't think those are going to be real helpful given the time we've got today, so we can skip through those. And then page 43, slide 43, rather, is one of the required measures that's in statute that the statute requires the Department of Education to measure. It asks them each year to do a measure between the 5th and 95th percentile on school districts on the basis of three categories of revenue, the basic formula, the local optional revenue, and the referendum. You can see that with the changes that were adopted over the last few years, that range has dropped pretty substantially and matches that range in about 2003 or thereabouts. So that measure of disparity has dropped some. Sometimes members want to see disparity measured on a different basis, like all general education revenue, and of course we're happy to provide charts like that as well. I mentioned earlier that special education is an area where there's a substantial cross-subsidy difference between revenue and expenditures. This annual report MDE does shows that cross-subsidy. There's a number of reasons for this that committee members should keep in mind. First of all, special education is partially funded by the federal government. When the federal government adopted their special education law, in the early 70s, there was a suggestion that they'd pay about 40% of the cost. The federal government pays about 16% of the cost, And for a whole variety of reasons, including some concern about whether supplanting would be allowed or not, there's ever optimism on the parts of legislators that the federal government may start paying a higher share, and if the state is already paying a full amount, if there's any supplanting language in the federal funds, that that would be a bad place to be. Second, there's a real concern about over-identification of special education students, and there's also a concern that perhaps our special education system is a less effective way to deliver funding than otherwise, if possible. And so I think there's been a general sense that the legislature, that some general education money that could be used more broadly and without all the restrictions of special education, maybe a way to head off future identification of special education needs in students. But there's a whole lot of reasons why, if from a theoretical perspective, one may not want to design a school finance system so that the special education revenue exactly equaled the expenditures. That said, one of the things you'll hear the most from about school board members is, gee, there's a real difference between the revenue and the spending we have for special education purposes, and it's a real conundrum. When you look at revenue distribution among school districts, if you go back to that general education revenue chart, you can see there's a lot of variation on general education revenue. There's also a huge variation on special education revenue. And sometimes when one's looking at closing the revenue gap between the high revenue and low revenue districts, if one were to put the funding on special education, that might extenuate or make slightly greater that disparity. And so there are all sorts of concerns to take in mind when thinking about that cross-subsidy. I think it's helpful for members to see how it changes over time and to see how it's computed, but I think it's wise not to immediately leap to the assumption that that's something that the full amount should be funded by the state legislature.
All right, and we do have some questions. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is too long for now, but so what are the financial can you put a scope on or what the financial incentives are for a district to classify a child as a special ed student as opposed to not?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I'd say under the state system right now, there's absolutely no incentive for districts to do that, that they lose, school districts and charter schools lose money on every special education student that they serve because they have to use some of their general fund money to subsidize that student's special education portion of their day. So I think in the abstract, one could certainly say, gee, you could lower that $801 cross-subsidy quite a bit before there'd be any incentive there for a district to say, well, let's offer a different kind of special education program because we know the full amount of that's going to be paid for by the state or some other manner. We have a current special education formula that's got three parts to it, and unfortunately it's kind of a messy formula to describe. Prior to 2013, that formula was, the 2013 legislative session, that formula was all cost reimbursement, and roughly 60-some percent of each district's eligible costs were reimbursed through that formula. The changes in first effective for 2015 were designed to try and put some specific categorical levels of funding depending on the student's type of disability into the system. But it's a mix of those as well as a few census items that currently drive our special education funding.
Other questions? Okay.
Madam Chair, the next slide deals with a program that was passed 2 years ago called the Long-Term Facilities Maintenance Revenue Program. One of the ways that school districts pay, essentially the main way school districts pay for new buildings is through bond issue and the annual repayment of the bonds through the debt service levy. For facilities maintenance needs, school districts essentially started falling into two classes of districts after some changes in the early 1990s. And those large districts that had more than 1.8 million square feet of building space were essentially eligible to do something called alternative facilities revenue to participate in that program. And about 25 school districts fell into that category, and those districts were able to levy. It was essentially all a levy program when it was created. Those districts were allowed to levy for any kind of long-term maintenance facilities, deferred maintenance needs. There was a separate program called Health and Safety Program that any district was eligible for that allowed them to do any kind of health or safety repair if the fire marshal came and said, hey, the school district needs new doors or part of this building is going to need to be sprinkled or you need to remove some asbestos. That could be paid for through a local levy through the health and safety formula. And then there was a small deferred maintenance formula for the ones that didn't qualify for alternative facilities. And for a number of years prior to this change, school districts were saying, gee, it's not fair that there's sort of two classes of districts. Some would need to do those things through bond issues, others voter-approved bond issues, others not. And so beginning in fiscal year 2017, a program called the Long-Term Facilities Maintenance Program replaced all of those programs, and it's essentially a formula-driven amount that's being phased in over a three-year time period. So by 2019, that formula will be at its statutory high point. Districts that had a larger amount of alternative facilities revenue prior to then will stay at that larger amount. But you can see here that all of the other districts are being brought up pretty substantially on their health, what used to be health and safety and deferred maintenance, from about $235 per pupil to an estimated $476 per pupil beginning in 2019. So on the facilities front, on the maintenance front, that change is phasing in and is narrowing that gap quite a bit between the very largest school districts and all the others in the state. As Ms. Adrian's told you yesterday, we're always measuring compared to base in this committee. That change is built into the base, so there's no added cost for this committee in terms of what it costs to go to that higher formula allowance because that's already in statute. Changes to that system, of course, if a higher allowance yet still for fiscal 20 were put into place, would then be measured against what the base is. But because this committee measures against base, that growth on the dotted line there is already built into the underlying budget assumptions. The next,
Mr. Strom, we have a question from Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the long-term facilities maintenance, are there any limitations with respect to, say, classrooms versus non-classroom space, hallways, bathrooms, things like that?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, I better double-check this. I don't want to tell you wrong, Representative Juergens. I don't believe there's any distinction where that maintenance can be carried out. It used to be we have a building lease levy, and under that levy, the building lease can only be used for certain instructional purposes. I believe the long-term facilities maintenance, and I'll double-check this, is it can be used for any part of the building, whether it's classroom or gym space. It's got to be for deferred maintenance activities, but if there's some sort of deferred maintenance that needs to be done, I don't think it has to be limited to just the classroom building. I hear voices, of course, but I have a little voice in my head that there was some issue about a school district's bus garage over the summer, and I'd better just double-check this, but I think that the long-term facilities maintenance covers all of the district's facilities, and it's not just limited to instructional space.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions about that or anything else? All right. Continue. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members are often asking how school districts are doing in terms of their fund balance, how many school districts we've got that are in, and charter schools that we have that are in terrible financial shape, et cetera. And we have a bunch of different measures we can use for this. Some of these measures are very helpful to us at the state level and less so to the individual districts. We have some accounting issues involved when we talk about reserved and unreserved funds. Sometimes a school district has an obligation to do something, but that money is not strictly reserved. So when they show their fund balances, they may say part of that unreserved general fund balance is really, really for a particular purpose and shouldn't be shown as just unreserved money. But it's a technical term that we use at the state level to determine this. And you can see over the past 15 years that school districts have beefed up their fund balance. Their unreserved fund balance has increased quite a bit from 10 to 20.9% in 2015. And again, your individual district may say, well, gee, that's that 20% on average that we have in the bank is not just unreserved. It's for some future needs that we've got. And so we can't just spend that on any purpose we want. But with our accounting definition of an unreserved general fund balance, this is what the data shows. Another way to think about that is to say, well, how many school districts have gone in the red? In Minnesota, if you have a negative general fund balance by more than 2.5%, you're in something called statutory operating debt, or SOD. We have very few districts now in 2015. We've only got a couple of districts that are actually operating in the red, where their general fund revenue is less by more than 2.5% than their general fund expenditures. And you can see that number fell pretty significantly in 2003, 5% or one out of every 20 school districts and charter schools was in the red in statutory operating debt. And you can see that other measure just saying, well, if you went negative at all, where are you? And you can see that that's ticked up just a teeny bit, but it's really at a pretty low level at 3.4% of the districts compared to 9.3% 12 or 13 years ago. So one takeaway from that is school districts have a bigger fund balance than they used to. In part, that's because in the years when the legislature needs to make aid payment shifts, school districts that have a larger general fund balance are often in a little easier place to weather those kinds of cash flow changes that the state may impose. But nonetheless, kind of an interesting statistic to keep in mind as to the overall health of the individual school districts and charter schools. A couple other slides to go through kind of quickly. One area where there tends to be a lot of crosstalk about what people actually mean is when we talk about pupil-teacher ratios. At the state level, the state calculates this by taking the number of licensed teachers in each building and simply dividing the number of pupils by that licensed teacher to get the number of pupils per licensed teacher. This measure can be done for individual districts as well. This measure doesn't really tie out to what most districts see because they have a number of licensed staff who are performing functions other than being direct instructional providers in the classroom. But nonetheless, it's a comparative measure over time that if one understands the basics of it, one can see how things have changed over time.
And Mr. Strom, asking for a friend and for constituents who asked me about this, So the actual pupil-teacher ratio of classroom size, and that is that reported on any of the information that's put out on MDE's website or not?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, it's not. There are a series of school accounting regions, and the one in the metro area, which I'm not sure if it's its current name or not, used to go by the name of Metro 2, would perform a survey every year. They'd survey all of the metro school districts and ask them to report their actual class size by grade by district. And that report was consistent. I'm not sure if they still do that report or not, but that was the metro-only districts that happened. And I'm not sure that there's a way on MDE's system to get an actual class size measure. And so for a variety of reasons, this is a measure to be very wary of. But as long as one recognizes the definitions, the change over time in this measure can be of some help.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next chart just shows this by strata, by the different categories of school district. And then if you go to slide 50, we wanted to just set the base for you. You've heard this in other places as well. You've probably all sat through a November forecast briefing, but I think it's sometimes helpful for this committee just to be reminded of where the situation is at. This committee will be asked to make education finance decisions for fiscal years 18 and 19. And if you look at the chart here, you can see how the 16-17 biennium is expected to wrap up and see that the fund balance pulled into the 18-19 year is $2.982 billion brought forth, that the revenue under the forecast assumptions, revenue of their best guess given the economy and the current tax structure we have, is expected to raise $45.3 billion for the current upcoming biennium. And the spending at the baseline levels, and remember that's what this committee will measure from, is the baseline level, that the baseline spending for the next 2 years, so that assumes pupil growth and things like that, but doesn't assume any change in any of the formula amounts, For this and all the other spending committees totals $44.58 billion, and that leaves a $3.7 billion balance before reserves. You can see that the cash flow reserve is currently at $2.28 billion. There's a relatively small reserve of $38 million for the stadium. And so when you take those two reserves off, then you have $1.4 billion on the bottom line. And as the legislature as a whole goes about setting its budget targets for each individual area, it's that $1.4 billion that will need to be determined whether to be allocated to the budget reserve or for health programs or for tax relief or K-12 programs. And that's really the magic number that we'll start from. As existing members know, the November forecast is what's used by the governor to make his initial budget recommendations. There's another forecast that comes out in February. The data in that forecast, for a whole variety of reasons, is in a lot better shape than it is when the November forecast comes out, and that's the data that the governor will rely on for his supplemental budget and that the legislature will use for making its actual decisions. So when the Ways and Means Committee adopts the budget targets, those will come after the February 2017 forecast is issued, and that $1.4 million could go up or down depending on how the changes wash out between the two forecasts.
And Representative Mariani has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strom. What's the relationship between the baseline spending and inflation?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, in the K-12 area, the base budget is determined by the formulas that are in statute. So essentially the general education formula, which is the single largest line item this committee sets, that's set at $6,067 for fiscal year 17 and each year thereafter. So the forecast assumes that because that's what the number in statute is, that that's where that number is going to be. There's not a general inflation adjustment to the state general fund budget anymore. In, I don't remember, 15 years ago maybe, or even a little longer ago than that. Some of the members that have been around a while probably have a better sense of that. There used to be some inflation estimates that were prepared as well. But for purposes of the forecast over the last 15 or so years, that has not been a factor in there. So instead, they look at what's actually in law for that period in time. And so in the K-12 area, as I mentioned, the pupil growth is something that's counted in the base because that's assumed to be part of it, since the formula allowance, for example, is $6,067 times whatever the pupil count is. And then the two areas with those individual inflation program growth areas are adult basic and special education.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to note that on the school report card, if you look at your school, you can find the ratio of licensed teachers to students, licensed teachers and support staff to students, and then ratio of all licensed staff to students. So that information is available locally if you want to check your school report card. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. That is good information to have. All right. And then, Mr. Strom, I know, and you have made clear, and we understand that everything is off of the base. When we look at funding, some chairs in the past have prepared a chart which shows actual dollars increase from one biennium to the next, which gives another perspective. Generally the base is how we budget things and that, but if members are interested in seeing that, I can ask that to be added as a column to the chart. So I'll put that out there, and if members are interested, you can let me know, and I'll just ask Ms. Adrians and Mr. Strong to make that add that category.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, we're very happy to do that or present data in any other way that the committee finds helpful. I would just add to that school districts usually measure compared to the previous year, and they don't use the concept of base. So they're often looking at their revenue from last year to next year and saying, well, how much new money are we going to get compared to last year? And when we look on our printouts at what we're showing, we're saying, what's the budget base for you? That may already be bigger than what you were asking for or what you got last year, maybe smaller because of some other changes, but that's that we're always measuring to base for purposes of what this committee needs to pay for, whereas the districts tend to budget by saying, how much do we need to offer the same program next year that we're offering this year? And so that creates a real difference in mentality in how people think about budgets and how they respond to increases or other changes.
Yes, and I would say in communicating with your school, particularly your school budget officers, it's important that you're on the same page in terms of the numbers you're communicating and what their understanding is, because sometimes that can create some confusion or misunderstanding. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Other questions on this? Okay, we'll continue. Thank you.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, that pretty much wraps up the PowerPoint for us. We, Ms. Adrians and I have all sorts of data that we're happy to reprocess for you. The Department of Education collects just a boatload of data, and much of that's on their website, often in a form that requires a little reprocessing for purposes of this committee's use, but we're happy to do that, and we're grateful for all the data that MDE does have available to us. As Representative Erickson mentioned, there's some reports like the report sheet, the report card report that shows some of that. There's something called a consolidated fund statement that the legislature asked the department to prepare and put on the website, which shows change by major category for each school district. There's some lookup tables that the department puts together where you can compare your district over time or your district to neighboring districts on a format that's, instead of being a district by district, one line per district, may have a whole page of information for each district. And those could be exceedingly helpful when we start making changes for you to share with your business managers and others in the district so that they can see the underlying base assumption, the difference, and what the previous year were or was for that column of revenue.
Very good. All right.
Okay, and Madam Chair, that pretty much wraps it up for us with the PowerPoint. I think we were going to, if it's all right with you, we'll spend a minute talking about the levy tracking sheet, and then we'll real quick dispose of the, or, and then I think we've got a fiscal note to talk about how a fiscal note works, and then we've got the printout from Representative Dabney that we can talk about as well.
Very good. Ms. Adrians, are we coming to you now?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. I will talk a little bit about it. I might let Tim jump in on some areas. We have the tracking sheet. I apologize. I didn't have it passed out earlier.
That's fine.
I think, once again, I'm not sure how deep you want to get into the numbers at this point. So along with our the spreadsheet we talked briefly about yesterday, we'll have a target for your levies. And so I will do a tracking sheet as well to kind of go over the levies. And I want to wait just a minute to make sure you all have it. And the chair mentioned yesterday that often you might get a zero levy target. So in that case, the numbers for the House position would just be the same as what's in sort of the base spending that you see in this sheet. So again, just to help you kind of go through it, there will be numbers on the side, letters for the columns on the top. I think that the levy sheet gets a little bit confusing, and Tim talked about this yesterday, where we have a payable year, a fiscal year, the school year, and so it can get a little bit confusing, but I think that the top line is going to be the fiscal year and then the payable year and whether it's certified or not. So once the numbers are certified, they're not going to change. And then for the budgeting years that the committee will be looking at for 2018 and 19 and then the tails, those are estimates of what amounts will be certified. He covered some of the areas that are in here, and I won't go through them too in depth. But so if you are interested in like the tree growth levy that we were talking a little bit about yesterday, you can kind of see where that's at for the certified years and then what the estimates are for 2018-19 and the tails. I think if you want to look at what kind of the big levy amount number is, if you look at the third page at the bottom, that's where you'll see sort of the grand total number. So this is so on line 197 for fiscal year 2017, the last year that was just certified. That's that $2.65 billion number. So that just to give you a sense of, you know, how that interacts with the spending that the committee has on the revenue and the aid side. I think that's useful. Want to add anything?
Well, and Madam Chair, I would add a couple things to keep in mind. Ms. Adrian's last line, 210, shows the change from the prior year. Here's an example where the change from the prior year is added. When we measure the K-12 actions of this committee, we'll show change to base, which will be zero unless something changes in here. But you can see that this shows the growth of that levy over time. And so you can see in the absence of any change by the legislature what the expected growth of the levy is. Now, there could be things in other committees that would reduce that. For example, if the school bond credit and the tax bill were to pass, that would knock $40 million or thereabouts roughly per year out of that levy. That would reduce essentially this line on here. The tax committee would actually carry that as a levy savings on their documents if it were passed in their bill, but the net result on here would be that that would show up as a lower levy level. Let me mention one other thing for you. If you go back to the top of the sheet on line 17, because we're predicting out into the future district behavior, for many of these formulas, it's not so hard because they're driven by a pupil count and a formula set in statute, but the one that gives us the biggest fits is estimating how many referendum are going to be approved and for what dollar amounts. And you can see here this is estimating out through fiscal year 2021, so 5 years out into the future, and the current best guess of the department is there'll be a total of $812 million of voter-approved operating referendum levy in that year. But it's always a wild guess to try and get there because who knows what else will change or how crabby or happy voters will be for additional property tax for an operating referendum. And so that line, line 17, is the one that will jump around the most in ways that there's certainly no better way than what the department does to guess, but it's still a wild guess and changes by tens of millions of dollars. We may see that the February forecast is slightly different on this, and by the time you take that out to 2021, could be a substantial difference there. Many years the guess has been over, and many years the guess has been under, and I think I'm glad it's not a job for me to estimate that because I think that's a very hard task. The other line item that's subject to voter approval is that basic debt service levy on lines 133 and 134, and it's sort of written into a couple other lines as well. But you can see there, too, there has to be a guess how many new school buildings are going to be approved 5 years from now, and what's the bond interest rate going to be, and how much levy is there actually going to be for those buildings in that year. And that's also a very tough guess to know where that'll be. I think just important to keep in mind that the levy guessing on voter behavior is a lot harder for us than when we can take a formula and take it against an estimated pupil growth.
Any questions on the levy tracking sheet? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, on line 138, additional maximum effort. Does that mean that those districts then will either have been forgiven or have paid?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, as existing members know, last year's bill essentially gave some significant benefits to districts and took away some significant advantages to districts to having outstanding maximum effort capital loans. And as a result of that, a number, I think seven of the nine districts with maximum effort loans refinanced their bonds to repay the state share of those bonds so that they're out of the maximum effort loan program entirely. There's an additional line being carried here for the levy authority that the districts had because of that. There's a state aid item as well, but that relatively small amount that shows up on line 138 is a result of the changes in that were enacted by the 2016 legislature. And basically about $61 million was repaid to the state last year or this last fall as those maximum effort loans were paid off. The two districts that remain with maximum effort loans are the Red Lake School District and the Net Lake School District, neither of which has any significant property tax base and could not refinance those locally. For most other districts, I am guessing that maximum efforts loans won't be something that they will pursue in the future. This year's bonding recommendations by the governor does include a maximum effort loan request for the Red Lake School District, and I'm not sure yet if this committee will be asked to examine bonding projects or not, but that's likely a project that you'll see, and that and Net Lake are the two districts that currently have the outstanding maximum effort loans.
Thank you.
And I know Representative Thiessen has a question before we go to him. Out of curiosity, and I probably knew this last year when we were talking about the supplemental and have forgotten since. So when we did the supplemental and we made the changes to the maximum effort, obviously we were going on an estimate of what schools would repay, and our best estimate was $50 million, which is the money that we appropriated then for some pilot projects. How is the additional money? You said 61 was repaid. So that additional $11 million, where is that accounted for in the state's budget?
Madam Chair, that money simply canceled to the general fund, essentially. So that makes a bigger general fund balance than would otherwise be. So $11 million more of the general fund balance was because of the 7th District deciding that it was in its interest to pay off its maximum effort loan.
Okay. Thank you.
What's that?
Let's go good. Well, I was going to say, you can all feel good about that. I guess we gave $11 million to the state's general fund. So, anyway, good. Any other questions on the levy sheet? All right. Okay. Whatever you want to move on to next.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Abrams will talk about a fiscal note now and how to read a fiscal note.
All right. Very good. Take it away, Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I hope the returning members don't find this patronizing at all. I think it's useful for the new members. It's a good thing to revisit for the returning members as well. The only reason I chose this fiscal note as one to use is that it was fairly straightforward. In education, the fiscal notes can get they can get pretty technical or kind of confusing. So this is nice because it's just more of a straightforward, if you have a change, how is the general fund affected by it? For the fiscal notes, traditionally, I will be the one who requests the fiscal note. So any bill that you would like a fiscal note requested on, I can do that for you. The committee administrators, Harry Kennedy, he can also request fiscal notes. Oftentimes, between myself and Tim, we can estimate the effects of a legislative change on our own as well. So don't hesitate to see if we can do that without requesting an official fiscal note. So if you look at the front page, the format is pretty much always going to look like this. You'll see in that table on the top right-hand corner, the boxes will be whether or not there's a fiscal impact, if there are expenditures, yes or no, if there are fee or departmental earnings involved, tax revenue, IT costs, or if there's a local fiscal impact. And the local fiscal impact, a lot of times they will talk about what might happen, but traditionally you don't get an actual number on that. So that's just more informative, but it wouldn't have an effect on the target, for example. So what this bill did was it was an increase, I think, in the reimbursement for participants in the school lunch program. And so the big information that you're looking for is whether or not there's a cost. So the first table is going to show you that to the general fund in fiscal year 2016, there is a cost, and it's about $3.5 million. These are in thousands as well. And then in 2017, 18, and 19, there are costs as well. Sometimes departments will suggest that they are that a change in legislation would require additional full-time employees. So that's what this FTE table would be. In this instance, they did not think that there would be any need for those. If you'll turn to the second page, the next table that they showed, this one is it's similar to the information that was on the front. If there would have been fees that would have brought revenue in, that would have been listed underneath it, and so you would have seen what the net impact would be. But for this one, it's just a straight cost to the general fund. And what's nice is they'll put in a little bit of a description for what the change does, and that's this information under the bill description. And then the department will make assumptions. Sometimes they don't have quite enough information to give an accurate cost, so they will say, well, this is what we think, or this is how we interpret the bill, and so they'll write those assumptions underneath there. And then this one has a lot of nice detail as to how they got to that cost, how they got to that $3+ million. And then, as I said, the local fiscal impact information, this one has a little bit of a blurb at the bottom. And then they'll always tell you who the agency contacts are. But again, if you have questions on any fiscal notes, usually you can just go through me and I can get additional information for you. Or if you have a question or you want to make a change, I can help with all that information.
All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you. And, of course, if you're on the tax committee, what she just told you changes a little bit. So you'll learn two different ways to read the revenue notes. And let's see. Are we now to the chart with the information that Representative Dabney asked about?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So, members, this was just passed out today. It's a spreadsheet entitled Free and Reduced Price Meal Count and Percent. And this was in response to the question that Representative Dabney asked yesterday. And again, generally it's this committee's practice to provide this information to all members because you're probably all interested in knowing the answers to these questions as well. Mr. Strom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just pull that up here.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. I just, you know, there's people that watch online in these committees or that are in the audience that can't, if it's possible to get these actually posted online while the committee's having a hearing, all these documents and PowerPoints, I think that that would be helpful and accessible so that people that are blind and et cetera can see them as well.
I agree, Representative Thiessen, and we will be posting these online. And moving forward, we'll have things posted as the committee, in time for the committee to start, so people can follow along.
Thank you.
Right.
Madam Chair, members, as we mentioned earlier, the compensatory revenue formula is based on both the free lunch count and the reduced lunch count. It's a concentration formula. At committee yesterday, Representative Dabney asked if there was any way for us to separate those two counts and compare how those have changed over time, and that's the document you have in front of you. And I apologize for the short time frames, Representative Thiessen. I didn't get this downstairs till just a little bit before committee here. So what we did is we grabbed data from the last available year we had, which was fiscal year 15, and then for 10 years back from fiscal year 2005, and show the counts on an individual district basis, and then summarized at the top of the printout by Minneapolis, St. Paul, Suburban, et cetera. We haven't had time to analyze this as carefully as we'd like, but a couple things to point out. The free lunch count statewide in 2005 was 185,000, and in 2015, 265,000. So that grew very substantially over that time period. The percentage point increase was 8.8%. The reduced lunch count actually changed very little over that time frame, which surprised me a bit. Went from 61,000 to 63,000 in 2015 for a 0.1% change. So interestingly enough, relatively little change there. You can see that total reduced lunch count is about a third of the free lunch count, 185,000 in 2005 compared to 61,000, and then in 2015, 63,000 compared to 265,000, so about a fourth of the count. And then what follows after the summary data at the top is an individual district printout, so you can see how those changes were by district. You can see that most districts had big increases in the number of students that were eligible for free lunch over this time period. A few districts actually, surprisingly enough, had decreases over that time period in that count. And then for the reduced price meals, that was pretty close to zero change in a lot of districts, but there were a couple of districts that had big changes there. As I said, we don't really have a good sense of why that necessarily happened. It could be that for those that went down, some of the free lunch students' families earned just a little bit more so that they could qualify for reduced price lunch, or there could be other things there. It could be that folks that didn't qualify before now qualify for reduced price meals. So we don't have a sense of the direction there. One last thing, as I mentioned yesterday, to add, the formula already weights the free lunch kids essentially as one. So if you're looking at the count in 2015, those 265,000 free lunch kids are counted as one when we put the pupil ranking or the pupil formula together, and the 63,000 reduced price kids are counted as half each for this formula. So we're counting about 31,500, 32,000 reduced count and 265,000 free count in the current year. So, Madam Chair, that's a brief summary of the data that's there on the spreadsheet. We hid the columns for the years in between on the file, but we could certainly show folks that. It would be a very wide spreadsheet, but that data is certainly available. And, of course, we're always happy to share spreadsheets with anyone if they prefer to look at the raw data themselves.
Thank you. Representative Scott has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have several on this. I think someone told me at one time this is a federal program, and what does someone need to do to qualify for free or reduced lunch? What kind of information do they have to provide to the school?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, in Minnesota and in many states, the first step that a school district takes is they're allowed to do a direct match to some DHS, Department of Human Services data for things like participation in the SNAP program and certain other medical programs. And so I think the number's about 70% of the free and reduced price lunch verification goes directly through that system, that matching. And then school districts send home a paper form to parents to fill out for their eligibility, and they report their income level and sign the statement that what they're reporting is true. Often those forms aren't turned back in, and the school district will send out a second or a third and sometimes a fourth form. The school lunch part of it is actually much less important to the school districts in Minnesota than the qualification for compensatory revenue. The compensatory revenue, as I said, is about $550 million. And so for a school district where each additional student that qualifies for compensatory revenue may mean another $1,000 or $2,000 even for the district, it's worth the district putting a lot of time and energy into getting that information processed. So the for the folks that aren't direct match, the school starts with the back-to-school packets and putting that information in there. The reporting date is October 1st, and then districts have a few more months. And by December, they wrap up those reports with the free and reduced lunch family verification that they were received, and then they report that information to the department. And we'll just in the next week or so be getting the fall 2016 counts, and we'll see how those compare to the fall 2015 counts. But MDE hasn't quite finished processing those yet, and districts are given a couple of months to pull those forms together, though technically it's sort of an October 1st fall count and then extra time to turn those forms in. But most of the match is actually done through direct match.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you think this is a national trend? Would you have the data nationally to see if this is kind of what's trending?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we'd be happy to look nationally and see. I'm guessing that the increasing percent of children eligible for free lunch is a national trend. I know it's a trend in a number of the other larger states. Ms. Adrians and I will check on that and get back to you on that, and we can show you how Minnesota's compared to the national trend on that.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And another question, is there data out there for deeper dives into this, like how many students that qualify for free or reduced lunches come from a single-parent household? Those sorts of data, are those out there?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's a good question. I'm guessing that the department's able to match some characteristics like ethnicity with free and reduced lunch status. I don't know on what basis the school district would have collected family information, so I'm not sure that there's any collection of data that would show whether the family was a two-parent family or not. I can't think of a form that would be on. But other characteristics like ethnicity or English language learning status, because of the tie-in to the MARS number, the department probably could generate a run for us that would show percent children that are white that qualify for free and reduced lunch. But I don't think anywhere in the school data that the family structure information is requested, including like on number of siblings or parents or anything like that. So I don't think that kind of data would exist from the annual free and reduced lunch counts. There may be income on information on the census data, you know, on the decennial census data that would allow us to speak to that more generally, but. But in the school formulas, I don't think we've got any data that MDE collects on that front.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Mr. Starm, just you said you collapse all the individual years between 05 and 15 are not on there. But do you recall, was it a rapid increase in free and reduced lunch, particularly the free lunch when the recession hit, and then people just haven't recovered off of that, or has it been a fairly gradual continual increase?
It was a fairly gradual increase for statewide. For some individual districts, there were big changes between the years, but statewide, it was a fairly stair-step relationship. Even before the recession in 2009, it was pretty much about 0.8% per year, and then it increased somewhat substantially for 2009 for the next couple of years. And then it's actually been flat now the last 2 years, and I'll be interested to see where this October's count is, whether it's remained flat this October or not.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
If you just indulge me for a second, I'm really intrigued by Representative Scott's questions in terms of whether this body, where does this body turn best, for information that isn't, for lack of a better term, quickly and automatically available, the kind of sifting and disaggregating that one has to do, for instance, to get at questions like Representative Scott. I'm intrigued, for instance, with Minneapolis, because there's a heck of a lot of school choice that's being exercised by parents in Minneapolis. I've seen the GPS maps where, you've got, students enrolling way over in East Metro, who are residents. From Minneapolis schools, so all over the Twin Cities. But I only know that because one individual went through all the work of pulling all that stuff together. Where do you go to? Where is it really, or maybe I shouldn't ask it that way. Are we pretty much bound by, whatever it is that MDE collects and then just someone going in and sifting it? Or are there other entities you mentioned census data, are there other data sets that one can creatively, easily combine with? I know some states are moving toward much more integrated data sets and sharing, for instance. What's kind of, this is a very long conversation, but just a very quick sense from you for this body. About where we can turn to get even better, if you will, disaggregated data.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, Ms. Adrian and I tend to rely entirely on MDE's data that they collect from districts. Occasionally, our office will do some survey data on a particular issue, particularly if it's not too much data. We may call 50 school districts to find out what their policy is or something like that. But in terms of all the raw data, that all comes to us from the MDE databases. And then often we'll reformat that. For example, on the open enrollment issue, we put together each year a spreadsheet that's online that allows you to plug in your district number, and then you can see what districts all the kids that are leaving your district are going to. Or alternatively, you can look at the other way. You can plug in your district number and see where the kids are coming from into your district. So you can sort of get some sense of that at the district-wide level. Most of the data in Minnesota that we tend to use here in the committee is at the district level. Some like compensatory is at the building level. One of the issues, of course, is whenever we get to building level data, we've got 2,500 buildings, and all of a sudden a 10-page printout's now a 50-page printout if we're going to be looking at it on paper or even scrolling through it. Another issue to think about with data is sometimes it's really nice to get the disaggregated data, but because of student privacy needs, it's important not to display small cell sizes. So, for example, if we had data that showed free and reduced lunch status by ethnicity and you had one American Indian student in the district, you'd know, well, gee, that student's low income or not. And so, generally speaking, you know, we want to be careful on the front of not having any district identifying data out there. And MDE does the same thing on a lot of the assessment reporting that they do, where there are small cell sizes where one can't see the performance at all of Latino low-income students in a small district because there's only seven of them. But that's a real question that we face. We don't tend to use census data much in this committee. In part, Minnesota's school district borders are a little bit organic and don't align nicely with other municipal borders. While we can get that census data at the block level, it's something that's just a whole lot less helpful to us, takes a lot of processing for us, and, of course, tends to be fairly far out of date by the time we can get the census data, whereas, for example, the free and reduced lunch counts, in a week or so, we'll have the counts from just this past fall, which is pretty quick turnaround. So that's another reason why we tend to be limited to the MDE data sources for our information.
Thank you.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Strom, we just talked briefly yesterday, and I said, I'm going to be one person that's going to ask for as much information as I can get because with St. Cloud, we've got so much going on. In fact, I just made the comment, just circle that one chart, that's my district. So it's always helpful to get more, for me, to get as much information as I can because I don't always know where to go, where to turn to help the district. And so when I see this, it's like we've increased 23% in 10 years, and I'm betting it's going to be quite a bit more in the next year. So numbers like that are always great, and I understand, you know, that not everybody supplies all the information. But I'm going to be one that's going to say, give me as much as you got, because it's really hard to know how to help them without really knowing what's going on. I mean, we're trying to do as much as we can with English language learners because there's so many in so many grades that they cover, and it's really hard when you get a student who they really don't know how old he is, but they place him in 10th grade because that's how old they think he is. And his first week is learning how to hold a pencil because he's never been to school ever. And so there's a lot of attention spent on him in trying to figure out how do we best take care of him, and then he's supposed to graduate in a couple years. I know a lot of the kids that come that are English language learners new to country are taking 6 years to graduate, which means that our graduation rate looks horrible because of some of those instances. So my focus is always how do I do the best thing for the district and where do we need to look. So just always keep me in mind I'm going to want more information, you know, and how do I best handle it and what areas do I need. So I really appreciate the presentation, and I do appreciate this data as well. So I'm going to be on your what do I want to say, your do not call list or something like that.
Madam Chair, Ms. Adrians and I love working with the school finance data, and any way we can process that and get it to members is nice for us. We like doing that. Representative Tice did ask for a printout similar to the compensatory on English learning. I didn't get a chance to get to that yet, but that'll be ready. I'll send that to both you and the committee administrator when that's ready, and perhaps on Tuesday you can all see that in your folders. But we'll show how those changes have happened over time. And as we mentioned before, we're glad to reformat things if we're not showing you what you need. If we're showing you 2 years and you really aren't interested in the percent change, but you really want to see 5 years of data, just let us know, and we're happy to reformat those things. And, of course, happy to do it outside of the committee time as well. But there's a vast storehouse of data there, and it informs your discussions on a whole number of the bills that you'll see in this committee. And we try when members have bills, for example, if there's a bill to increase English learning revenue, we'll try to have a printout there that will inform members about what those percents look like in the districts and what that revenue distribution might look like. So sometimes we get a little behind on that, but we're glad to help however we can.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Strom and Ms. Adrians are incredibly helpful. So we are very fortunate to have their advice and information gathering capabilities for this committee. It's extremely helpful. Other questions? Did we have any other charts or anything to review with us? Not that I'm asking for more.
No. Madam Chair, we will work on some equalization printouts, as that's an important concept, and yes. As the discussion about the ag credit increases, we'll probably have some information for this committee about that as well. But if you or any of the members think that there's a printout or some data that's helpful, just let us know.
All right. Very good. All right. If there are no other questions, I think we finished for today. Tomorrow we have Commissioner Caselius, who will be with us to talk about ESSA and some other things. So we'll look forward to that discussion. And with that,
meeting place, you should announce the meeting place for that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes, we are. It's a joint hearing, which I should have mentioned. So we are meeting jointly with the Education, Innovation, and Reform Committee. And so we needed more space. So we're meeting in the Capitol, room 120, at this meeting time. So tomorrow at 1 o'clock, but in the Capitol, room 120. Thank you for that prompting. So with that, if there's nothing else, we will be adjourned for today. Thank you.